The next and final matter on our oral argument calendar this morning is in the matter of the civil commitment of Anthony Blake Swope. Counsel, while you're getting situated, and there's no need to rush, I'll just remind you of our rules. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument and be mindful of the timing restrictions that are indicated in the light and clock in the lectern, which you can raise or lower to your height at your convenience. There's a button right in front. And whenever you're ready to proceed, again, not rushing you, but when you're situated, you may have the floor. Counsel for appellant.
May it please the court. My name is Todd Zettler. I represent appellant Scott County. There are two primary issues in this case. I'm sure the court is familiar with both the facts and the record, and I'll certainly address any questions the court has. But the first issue is essentially whether the district court was right that the Civil Commitment Act authorizes attorney's fees to be charged to counties in right to treatment litigation against the Commissioner of Human Services. The second issue is a more basic attorney fee dispute and whether the fees were correct or not. I intend to focus mostly on the first issue, whether the Civil Commitment Act authorizes district courts to charge counties with attorney's fees.
Big picture question. Assume there was no Civil Commitment Act, wouldn't we be looking just at the contract between the parties?
You would if there was an appointment, but there wouldn't have been an appointment because there wouldn't have been any basis to charge the county with attorney's fees. So if there is no Civil Commitment Act, there is no basis to charge the county with attorney's fees.
And is there any, I'm looking at the scope of services part of the contract, I was looking for specific limitation of services. Consistent with what's being argued or paralleling what's being argued here. Is there something in the scope of services in the contract itself that would supplement your limited attorney fee argument?
No, the discussion in the contract was intended to create efficiency in cases where attorneys are appointed by the district court. So that it discusses various types of cases, and civil commitment is one of the types of cases mentioned. So the point of the contract was to create efficiencies when the district court appoints counsel for people. And in this case, under the Civil Commitment Act, when they're undergoing the commitment process. So that's the basis of the contract. And in this case, after reviewing that contract, Scott County determined that the work performed was outside of what was covered in the contract because it was not part of the Civil Commitment Act. It wasn't part of the civil commitment at all. It was, in fact, separate right to treatment litigation with a mandamus and a habeas litigation against the Commissioner of Human Services. So that's when Scott County rejected payment, and that's the basis of the rejection.
Just to be clear, the basis of the rejection, I know there's an argument now being presented about the reasonableness of the fees and cost and Lodestar method. Was that presented in the district court, or is that just new on appeal? When is the first time that came
out? That was presented in the district court. That was litigated. So there were sort of two chunks of litigation, if you will. The first chunk was, how were these divided big picture? Can the county be held responsible for this right to treatment litigation? That's piece one. Piece two is, what are the reasonable fees? Now, that's based in large part on how piece one turns out, but it's also looking at the reasonableness of all the fees, including the fees in the commitment case. And the Lodestar method was, in fact, presented to the district court by Jeannie Anderson in both affidavit and in argument.
Counsel, I just have a collateral question of sorts. Under the statute, I think we all agree on the appellant here had the respondent here had a right to be admitted to a state treatment, must be admitted to a state reported operated treatment program in 48 hours. He was committed on September 14th. He was transferred on November 16th. So there isn't any question that he was just sitting there without receiving treatment in violation of the statute.
Correct.
So your argument is that some other attorney should have helped him?
My argument is that that's right to treatment. That's outside of the civil commitment process, and that's not just my argument. That's the case law.
So you're not responsible for the fees, is what you're...
We're not responsible for paying the fees, and there's no right to counsel, in fact, for that.
Okay, but didn't the Navarro-Till case mention... confirm what you said, the commitment process is not the proper avenue for asserting right to treatment, and then listed a habeas petition as one of the options?
Yes.
Okay. And isn't that in part what they did here?
It is exactly what they did here, and that is outside of the commitment process, which is explicitly stated in Navarro-Till and in previous cases. Navarro-Till states, and I'll quote, the commitment process is not the proper avenue for asserting a right to treatment argument, Navarro-Till. And a committed person has adequate avenues, and this is the important part, outside the commitment process for asserting a right to treatment issue. It then cites Travis, there's also Walsh, where it gives numerous options for what these processes are outside of the commitment process. So habeas, which is both state and federal, 1983 litigation, can be an injunction. There's all kinds of things that happen outside of the civil commitment process to pursue the right to treatment litigation.
But doesn't the MLTA specifically refer to habeas?
I'm sorry?
Doesn't the Treatment Act refer to habeas petitions?
It says nothing in this act is intended to abridge the habeas rights. And they couldn't abridge it even if they wanted to. It's a constitutional right. It's not a statutory right.
I'm not talking about the statute. No, I am talking about the Treatment Act. You're saying it doesn't...
Subdivision 5 of the, if I'm understanding your question, Subdivision 5 says nothing in this is intended to abridge a person's rights under habeas. And I can...
All right. That's all right.
So that...
I have a question just sort of logistically in the normal course of these things. So after a district court orders commitment, are there still, is there still work that the attorneys have to perform after that order is issued on behalf of the client?
Yes.
Okay, and is that work that historically under the contract the county has paid for?
Yes.
Okay, so, but that work is not a quote-unquote proceeding under the chapter.
It would be, and we would still be responsible for it. But so there are ongoing things that happen. Reports are issued and that kind of thing. That is de minimis attorney involvement as far as the ongoing commitment in the district court. That is not bringing habeas actions for right to treatment litigation, which is what happened in this case and is what the difference is. So some fees would still be existing in the Civil Commitment Act, in the commitment in Scott County District Court. But that's not what happened here. But what we're disputing is the main thing, which is the whole litigation against the Commissioner of Human Services in the right to treatment litigation.
It seems to me this case turns on that phrase, any proceeding under this chapter.
It does.
Okay, and so if we have other work that is being performed, and when the proceeding is over, the commitment has happened, that should be the end of that proceeding. But you, historically, under the contract, you're still paying for that other work, which may be de minimis, but it's still work that's being performed that's no longer a proceeding.
Because that's why this commitment is still open. The person is still under commitment in Scott County. So they're still receiving reports. That's still under the chapter. That's not anything different.
But the chapter also says 48 hours, right? And so you have this 48-hour rule that they have to be moved. And so why isn't that a violation of the proceeding in which these attorneys who are still appointed have to do some work on behalf of their client?
Because every case from this court says that that's right to treatment litigation, which cannot be brought under the Civil Commitment Act. Every case, Travis, Navarro-Till, Walsh, all of them hold that. So this isn't an open question. And what they're asking for, if you jump to the end of their brief, is a new rule of law. They want this court to say, you do have a right to counsel in these habeas extraordinary proceedings. Because right now, you don't. There is no right. And if there's going to be that right, it needs to come from the legislature, not from a district court forcing Scott County to pay for it.
So the result, just to be clear, is that people can sit after being committed in the counties throughout the state of Minnesota. I realize that the statute's been amended, but they could sit there in violation of the statute indefinitely because they don't have counsel, correct?
I'm not sure if that's, I don't, as a hypothetical, I'm not sure that that's correct or not. I don't know what ongoing monitoring a district court would have. I mean, that's certainly not what happened here, but that's discussed in other cases where there's, for instance, in Epson and Benson cited in my brief, where there's no placement for these, for in those cases, the treatment for chemical dependency, I believe. There was no placement within the time period. So this court still said, that's outside of the civil commitment process. You can't bring these actions in the civil commitment process. That's right to treatment, and you have to bring a separate action. Over and over again, this court has said exactly that, because you can't bring the Commissioner of Human Services into this case. That has to be separate. The right to treatment litigation is simply not part of the civil commitment.
After the district court issues the order committing the individual, could the county file a motion to have those the attorneys discharged from the appointment?
No, I mean, not successfully, and I don't know why they would initially, but because they have a right to representation during the civil commitment process pursuant to the Civil Commitment Act.
When would that process end? When I'm just not sure. When is somebody discharged from the appointment?
I don't know exactly. In this case, there was an order that was entered, but even if they're discharged, they can be recommitted. They can come back on a new commitment, but that is a new commitment under the Act. So it's still a proceeding under this chapter every single time.
Just to be clear, so your argument essentially is it's not a, habeas is not a proceeding under the chapter, despite the fact that the chapter would confer rights that would make a habeas petition necessary to enforce, as in this case.
Well, the only thing that the chapter says is, under subdivision 5, nothing in this chapter shall be construed to abridge the right of a person to the writ of habeas corpus. That's it. That's not incorporating the, all of these other rights within this, and that's not saying because you still have a right of habeas corpus, nothing in here abridges that. You suddenly have the right to an attorney representing you in habeas proceedings.
To, in practical effect, the client would have to find other counsel.
Correct.
For the.
In practical effect, there is no right to treatment.
Correct.
Within 48 hours.
Well, now there's no statutory right, but correct.
But back then, there, you mentioned the legislature had needs to act. Well, so they amended it, but back then they didn't, and it was just ignored, that 48 hours.
It wasn't ignored. People tried, I believe people tried to comply with it, and you have the Attorney General discussing the issue, and you have lots of discussion of that. So I don't believe that people are just willy-nilly ignoring it. People are trying to comply with it, and there's been extensive litigation since then about what that means and what the impact is. And the fact is and was there are not enough resources to accommodate all of this, all of these people that need this. So it's not simply ignoring it. It's they're ranking, they're analyzing. It's an ongoing thing by the Commissioner of Human Services, which is why the Commissioner of Human Services is the party that needs to be brought into this, be sued for the right to treatment, which is what they ultimately did. But Scott County cannot be made to pay for that because the legislature has not authorized that.
Could Scott County seek to recover the fees from the commissioner? I mean, it seems like the 48-hour rule, the violation is not necessarily the fault of the county. It's the commissioner not moving the person. And so why couldn't you recover the fees from the commissioner and say, look, you're the one who violated this rule?
I've never seen litigation like that. I don't know.
And Scott County would take no position, I would imagine.
Right. I have 20 seconds left, unless there's any other questions at this point.
Doesn't appear to be any, but you'll have 5 minutes.
Thank you.
We'll have 5 minutes to think about more questions, and you'll have 5 minutes to prepare for them. You'll have rebuttal. Thank you. Counsel for respondent, rebuttal.
I'm sorry, where's the button? Oh, here it is. May it please the court and opposing counsel. My name is Mallory Stoll. I represent the respondent in this appeal, Jaspers, Moriarty, and Weatherall. I may refer to them as JMW or simply the respondent in this matter. Your honors, counsel for appellant did address the fact that we really are here raising two issues on appeal. Where I would like to start my remarks on behalf of respondent is really what issues were in fact preserved for appeal. If we look at the appellant's brief and the way that the issues were stated, it doesn't state, the issue ultimately was not whether, is there a right to court-appointed counsel? Is there or is there not a right to pursue mandamus litigation? This really comes down to an issue where Scott County doesn't want to pay the fees. So I am planning to address that in further detail in my argument. When we ultimately look at what happened in this case with regard to Mr. Swope, this is ultimately about the attorneys at JMW delivering not only what matters for their clients, but what is statutorily required. That is zealous and vigorous advocacy for inmates in judicially recognized mental health crisis who require commitment and who remain unlawfully housed awaiting treatment. Those are rights that are guaranteed to them not only under the statute, specifically the Commitment Act, but also the Constitution. Scott County, as I said, is really only challenging whether they're the ones that are responsible for payment of these fees. And so turning right to that, I do want to point the court's attention to the transcript from the December 2022 motion hearing that really gets to the heart of what arguments and what issues were presented to the district court. As I already said, Scott County did not challenge below that Mr. Swope had the right to court-appointed counsel in a proceeding related to the writ of habeas corpus or mandamus. If this court looks to page 19 of the transcript from that hearing, Scott County told the district court that, quote, in this situation, the county absolutely supports that this sort of thing is not good. The county does not like that someone is sitting at the jail. It supports that there are efforts to challenge, change, and manage that, end quote. Next, Scott County did not challenge at the district court below that persons in the situation, such as Mr. Swope, are entitled to pursue relief with the assistance of court-appointed counsel. When asked by the district court if Scott County disputes that Mr. Swope had the right to court-appointed representation in the mandamus action, Scott County stated on page 20 of the transcript that it, quote, doesn't take a position on that. When we talk about persons in this situation, to use the county's words, we're at a minimum talking about persons like Mr. Swope, persons committed already to the Commissioner of Human Services, who at the time that this case was pending, were entitled to priority admission under the Act within 48 hours of the commitment, and who, in fact, are not admitted as the law required at the time. For the first time on appeal, appellant's brief really focuses and raises all of these issues not challenged below, and now is seemingly challenging whether there is a right to court-appointed counsel and whether mandamus is available to vindicate a constitutional and statutory right to treatment that is recognized by case law. As they state...
Just to be clear, there's a difference between, you acknowledge, I assume, a difference between a constitutional or statutory right to treatment and the state's obligation through counties to pay for that, pay for legal services to vindicate those constitutional rights.
Yes, I would agree with that. I also want to turn back to the transcript with how this issue was raised and really what was argued below. And if we look at page 19 of the same transcript that I have referenced, Scott County says, quote, "The real issue is who's responsible for paying from the county's perspective something like this." Scott County suggested during that transcript, if the court looks at that, when they suggested that the state may be responsible, Judge King followed up and said, "Is it your position that the state is responsible for payment of those fees?" Scott County responded on page 20 of the transcript, quote, "Somebody else, Your Honor. Quite honestly, I mean, we're not, the county doesn't necessarily have a position, just that it's not the county." So what we're left with, given that the district court did determine that the mandamus, that a mandamus action is a proceeding under the act, despite the fact that it is a different court file number, that's what our case law tells us. What we're really left with at the end of the day, respondent would submit, is 253B.23, which references costs of hearings and how those are paid. If the court looks to 253B.23, subdivision 1, it talks about how the county treasurer specifically, is responsible for paying a reasonable sum for travel and for time spent in court or in preparing for the hearing. If we go below to subdivision 1B, it does discuss certain expenses, or it further clarifies that there's a county of financial responsibility who pays those costs under the act, costs that are incurred for court-appointed representation. So respondent quite simply would submit that the act is the start and end of how we determine who is responsible for payment of these fees that we have been discussing this morning. I think we're still in. Because the county did not properly preserve the issues for appeal that it is now arguing in its brief, and because of the fact that Thiel v. Stitch would otherwise preclude this court's review or addressing arguments raised for the first time on appeal, respondent requests that the court affirm as to the first issue. I want to turn next to the amount of fees. I want to just spend a little bit of time on this.
Before you get to the amount, I have a question for you.
Yes.
Besides being a non-precedential opinion, the Epperson case seems to be not great for your position. That's one where the individual sat in detox, even though it was ordered to be committed. It gets into the point of you can't join the commissioner in these commitment proceedings, but that case seemed to be, like I said, not great for your position. So I just wanted to give you a chance to talk about that one. Tell me why it shouldn't apply.
Your Honor, I am trying to find the Epperson case so I can fully respond to your question this morning. I'm afraid I'm going to take too much time trying to refresh my recollection of that case. I do know I will be seeing you in 8 days on this issue for the Lee matter, and I will be addressing it at that time, if that's okay.
Sure.
Okay, thank you. I don't want to ramble unnecessarily and want to make sure I really think about that response, and I have that unique opportunity to do so in this case. So, but I do want to just, I guess what I will say for today, Judge Schmidt, is that I think ultimately what is important for this court to keep in mind, and certainly I'm not suggesting the court doesn't understand this, is the question that you actually posed to opposing counsel Judge Schmidt, which is a mandamus action any proceeding under the act? Any proceeding is the term that is used under 253B.07. And of course, let me make sure I got that right. 253.07, subdivision 2C. When we think about what mandamus actions ultimately are, they're extraordinary writs. Extraordinary writs are the only way to compel performance of a right that is clearly defined under under a statute, and in this case, under the Act.
But is it a proceeding under the Act? I guess that's the I mean, if we're looking at the legislative language in specific, you know, there's entitlement to fees for a proceeding under the Act. How is a habeas petition a proceeding under the Act?
Judge Ross, I think that answer really turns on what is the definition of proceeding. From my perspective,
I would suggest that maybe it's under the Act, but that's what it hangs on.
Well, and so
but you can answer any way you like.
Yes, absolutely. So to stick to how what you were focusing on, Judge Ross, there would not be a mandamus action such as the one that occurred in this case without the Act, because the entire purpose of the mandamus action was to enforce a right under the Act. What we're really dealing with is we happen to have
the legislature didn't choose that language. The legislature didn't say a procedure to enforce rights under the Act, but instead a proceeding under the Act.
But I think the problem we run into is what the court was addressing with opposing counsel, which is how would we ever meaningfully and actually vindicate a right, those rights under the Act through something like extraordinary writs? And we do also have additional, within the Act itself, mentioning that this doesn't in any way abridge the right to habeas relief, what have you. I don't view the statute, and that's where the ultimate right to court-appointed counsel and what we've been talking about today is rooted. There's nothing to suggest that that would not in turn apply to court-appointed counsel in a mandamus proceeding. That is rooted in enforcing rights to treatment under the Act, meaning the right to treatment. And I just want to also note that I'm just going to pose this out loud, and I know I at least raised it in one of our briefs here. You know, it seems like the issue that really came up, and unfortunately I would say that it's the Navratil and progeny that kind of created this confusion among district courts, is the fact that a parallel proceeding is ultimately required in order to proceed with a mandamus action, in this case, pursuing a right to treatment where the commissioner has certain duties. It really seems we're talking about the fact that because we have two court files with two different numbers, that's the confusion and that's the start and end. And I just don't personally find that to be sensical or logical, that because we have different numbers that alone would really resolve this issue. I want to turn back to the amount of fees, just really briefly spend some time on this. The second issue really is reviewed for an abuse of discretion. I would submit to this court that if the court looks at both the January 2023 and August 2023 orders, the court does make findings regarding the factors under the Lodestar method. The January 2023 order includes findings regarding JMW and their attorney's experience, reputation, and ability. They had been providing representation under the contract since 2007. January 2023 order talks about the nature and difficulty of the responsibility assumed, perhaps pursuing a path that is not all that common, perhaps unusual, but certainly, as the case law and as the district court acknowledged, a path that is available and, in fact, was successful for Mr. Swope. The January 2023 order also addressed the results below, which were favorable to Mr. Swope. And finally, the August 2023 order really looks to the reasonableness of the fees in terms of the work that was performed, having multiple attorneys working on the case, as well as making some minor reductions to the overall invoices. I want to spend the last 2 minutes of my time, Your Honors, on the fact that respondents request that the court issue a precedential decision in this case, and I do think it's very important that this court does.
Before you do that,
yes.
Going back to your waiver argument or preservation of issues argument, I'm not sure that the district court's analysis tracks well with your argument of failure to preserve the issue. It seems as if the district court, in fact, treated the argument of counsel as if it were making the argument that you're saying wasn't made, which is the scope of 253B.
I'm sorry, Judge Ross. Could you, I want to make sure I answer your question. Could you say it one more time to make sure I followed?
Like your argument is that when it was in front of the district court, you know, that this argument is new on appeal, that the county wasn't obligated to pay for the habeas proceeding because it wasn't a proceeding under the Act and is under the chapter, as the statute says. But as I read the district court's reasoning as to why it was granting the fee request, it was considering that very issue. Correct
yes.
me if I'm wrong.
I do agree that's what the court addressed, but I would go again to the fact that Scott County wasn't challenging to the district court that there wasn't the right to court-appointed counsel in the mandamus proceeding and that the court-appointed attorney had the right to be paid. Those weren't challenged.
It seems as if the court's is there language in the court? Why would the court go into the analysis that it did if that wasn't what the court understood the challenge to be?
I don't pretend to venture into Judge King's mind to answer that question. I guess what I would answer with just with my time.
I guess my point, doesn't the analysis undermine your argument that the argument in the district court was not the same that it was here?
But I think the problem is Scott County didn't raise those arguments to the district court so that the court could address them.
But if the district court perceived that the county was raising those arguments and analyzed as if the county had raised those arguments, is that not enough to preserve the issue? Or are you saying that didn't happen?
Well, I think the district court had to make those findings in its the January 2023 order because, of course, the court does need to determine if there are fees that, I guess, whether there's court-appointed representation and whether fees are need to be paid, you have to find a source for it under the Act. So I feel like if the court didn't say anything about it, I question what would have been in the order. I might have to think about that one a little bit in the next 8 days, too. I definitely want to answer that.
Could I paraphrase? Are you suggesting that this is all just sort of prefatory remarks by the district court?
No. No, I'm not. I do see my time is up, so I will simply ask that this court affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant.
Todd Zettler for Scott County. First, the argument being made by respondent that everything necessary under the Act is under the Act would swallow the rule. All right to treatment litigation would be under the Act. You wouldn't have any limitation, and clearly that's not the law. So that cannot be the case since that's not the case under any of this court's cases. I don't understand the waiver. The state has, or Scott County has been arguing this from the very beginning. And finally, as to the Lodestar method was never discussed by the district court. The Lodestar method was argued by both parties, and counsel today says that multiple attorneys were approved under the Lodestar because of the difficulty. She approved multiple attorneys because she said, well, one side had multiple attorneys, so the other side should too. That's not a Lodestar factor. The amount was reduced by $30. So this was basically a blanket approval of every fee requested. Unless there's other questions.
I do have a question. On the 48-hour rule, is that really a right to treatment rule? The way I read the statute here, it says patients described in this paragraph must be admitted to a state-operated treatment program within 48 hours. It doesn't say treatment must commence. It to me, must be admitted is the key language there, where it means you have to be transported from jail to somewhere else, to a treatment program. Now, whether treatment starts on day one or it starts 6 months later, different question. But here it's talking about the 48-hour rule, seems to me, about admission, and which gets into the transporting. So my question is, like, are we really in a right to treatment world because it seems to me this is more about admission to a facility, which then gets into the idea of, all right, we have a violation of the rule. What do they do about it? Because they're still sitting in jail.
I understand. I follow the logic. But the only point of the 48-hour rule is to get them into treatment. The only point of that is to get them exactly where they ultimately need to be. So that is the right to treatment. And that's how this court has interpreted similar situations in the past, in Epperson and so on. So I understand the logic of the argument, but I think that that's not supported by a case law as far as having the county pay for it.
Is there any case that discusses that distinction?
No.
Is there any case that would resolve that distinction?
I think all the cases, really, because they all talk about the habeas being outside of the commitment process, and that's what we're getting at.
But habeas to have treatment within 48 hours.
Habeas to have treatment, yes. And since the 48 hours is the treatment mechanism, I would ask this court to reverse the district court and remand for further findings and hearings. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your argument, for your briefing in the matter. Nicely done. We'll issue an opinion within the statutory period. The matter is submitted.
And
this being the last case we have in our oral calendar for today, the court is in recess.